Mojave Beach Productions.
Mojave Beach Productions present Podcast Excursions, a series that listeners may depend on for conversations and observations from individuals who strive to provide quality programs that entertain, educate, and enlighten.
So, Diane Lawson, Diane and I have done, two or three. We did Dreams, Their Power and Their Purpose. Have we done any more?
Yes, we have. And I can't remember off the top of my head what they were.
We did one about spirits and
the paranormal. Oh, we did one about my book, didn't we?
No, we talked about it. We meant to.
Maybe we should have. Maybe we should.
That would be fun to talk about.
What's
it called? Extraordinary Relationships to Astrology.
Right.
And that's because you're an astrologist that earns her living that way. And this one is going to be on ghost stories, but true ghost stories.
I've lived in two haunted houses, and the interesting thing about both of those houses is that several people experienced things in that house. It wasn't just me. It was several people.
Mm-hmm. Was that while you were living here in Topeka, Kansas?
Well, that's in the house I'm living in right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The house I've been in, it's got ghosts in it?
Yes, it does.
I didn't know that.
It doesn't anymore. John got rid of the ghost, actually, by telling them to leave. He created a ritual and told them to leave. And I believe that most of the time, if you command ghosts to leave, they need to leave. And I've had that happen in two different houses, and they've left.
That's interesting. Let me preface this whole thing by saying, my friend Joe and I used to go out and give these haunted stories around Halloween. We called them Spirited Mysteries. And we were asked to tell our little stories at a landmark place. I forget what, a big, well-known historical house in St. Louis. And we were told that they'd sold all the tickets. And so we show up and we're expecting a bunch of adults. And it turns out they're very young Girl Scouts. Oh my gosh, I don't have any stories for little children. When I give my talks about ghost stories, I always started it, when I'm talking to adults, I always start it with, what is the difference between a ghost and a spirit? Well, that's a rhetorical question. I expect anybody in the audience to answer me, but no, little girls, they got one hand up, it's wiggling around. I know. So I called on this little girl in the front row. And I said, you know the difference between a ghost and a spirit? She said, yes, ma'am. A ghost is when you don't know them, and a spirit is when you do.
Oh.
Isn't that darling?
Well, there's a lot of truth to that.
So tell me about your house. You're going to talk about this house you're in right now.
The house I'm in right now,
okay.
Yes.
In Topeka with John.
Right. I lived there with four of my kids, and one of them soon moved out and went off to college. But it started when I noticed that one of my books would be pushed in and not in line with the other books. Back then,
on a bookshelf.
I had a lot of books in bookshelves, and I was pretty obsessive about them being in a straight line. Nice, neat, straight line. And I had this one big, fat book, the Encyclopedia of Homemaking Ideas, and it would always be pushed in. And I assumed it was my kids being passive aggressive and pushing it in to get my books out of alignment. And I kept asking them, who's doing this? Are you doing this? And they would deny it for years, every single day. And the book continued to be pushed in. And I thought, well, maybe it's because the book is bigger than the other books that are around it. And I thought maybe somehow that caused the book to move. So I kept moving the book to see it would still be pushed in every single day. Several other people in that house experienced things that I cannot explain. I had a man friend who was there, and he was out on the front porch smoking. And he looked into the living room window when he was on the front porch, and he clearly saw what appeared to be a man, a real person, in the living room, looking at him through the window, and then the man just dissipated.
So did he come in and tell you?
Yeah, he was quite concerned because he had never had anything happen to him like that.
Did he describe him? Was he anybody you recognized from the description?
No.
Was he dressed in modern clothes or what?
Modern clothes.
And you think it was the first and only time he'd been there, or was he the one pushing the book? Is there a connection?
Oh, I don't know. But then my daughter at this time was in high school, and she had a boyfriend who was over, and then he left. He got in his car, and he looked in the rearview mirror, and he saw that same man sitting in his back seat.
How do you know it was the same man?
Well, the description of the two people described the same middle-aged man, modern clothes. Anyway, he came. He was kind of a macho dude, 19 years old, and he came running into the house, almost hysterical, and told us because he was just freaked out beyond belief. He had never had anything like that happen to him before. That same boyfriend took my daughter to the prom, and they came back with one of these huge pictures and kind of these, they're not really cloth or cardboard frames, but it was like an 11 by 14 picture, and it would be up on the buffet in the dining room. And he said every time he came over, it was face down. And why was my daughter putting the photograph face down? She said, I'm not doing that. It just must fall. So anyway, he propped it up, and the two of them left that room and went into the kitchen to get some pop, and then came out, and the picture was not only face down, but it had a pile of books on top of it. And they were pretty terrified. And probably the scariest thing happened to my son, Brian. He was in grade school, and he was sitting on the couch across the living room. He saw our cat. It looked as if the cat got picked up by an invisible person around the center. So the cat was suspended a little bit in midair with its four legs dangling. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the cat was thrown across the room onto Brian's lap. So those are the big things that happened in that house.
You know, when I sit on my sofa and I can see my staircase in the dining room, I can see the staircase that goes upstairs. Well, sitting on my couch in the living room from about the middle of the staircase up is in total darkness at night. The bottom part gets the ambient light from the living room, you know, the lamps and things. And I can't tell you how many times those cats sit on my lap or will be cuddled up close to me, and then in unison will perk up their ears and look at the same spot on the staircase. And I always follow their look. They're all watching one thing. You know, they're all looking at the same thing. And I will look at the same spot, and I said, well, devils aren't allowed in here, so you must be of God. And if that's the case, then welcome. And I just try to forget about it. But that happens frequently.
Oh, Esther, that reminds me of another thing that happened in that house. We had a Cairn Terrier that looked exactly like Toto in The Wizard of Oz. And it would stand in the middle of the living room. And you know how dogs go bark, 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 and kind of go forward and back and forward and back when somebody is there they're barking at? It would do that and kind of go around in a circle around where somebody apparently was standing, as if somebody would be there in the middle of the living room barking. And we didn't see anything or any reason for the dog to be doing that. And then I had a client who came over to my house who was sitting on my couch, and she had lost a son who was murdered. And the dog did that same kind of thing around her when every time she would come over, it would do that bark, 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 you know, forward and back, like it saw somebody sitting on the couch beside her. And she said, oh, he's seen my son. He appeared to be seeing something that nobody else could see.
I think animals too. You know, there's another thing. I was just asking you if I ever told you the story about my father-in-law, and you said you hadn't heard it. My father-in-law was in a terrible automobile accident, and the body wasn't going to live. And at the same time, I had just had my son, Dean. And so as my father-in-law fooled the doctors and continued to get better, he finally was released and came home. And about the time he came home, Dean was just learning or trying to pull himself up, you know, at a coffee table or whatever, trying to stand up. And then he'd plop back down on his little bottom. Then he'd try again. And one day, my father-in-law said, "Dean and I are going to learn to walk at the same time." And he looked at Dean and he grinned and he said, "We're going to walk, buddy." Well, unfortunately, about that time, my father-in-law took a turn for the worse, and he did die. Now, at that time, I was working and my husband was working, and I had a housekeeper named Rowena. I had a television show then, and my hours, I think I left the house around 10, and I got back around 3 in the afternoon. So Rowena, she would get there at 10, about the time I was scheduled to leave, and she would leave when I got home, which was at 3. So she had never met my husband. They had never been there at the same time. So one day I come home at 3 o'clock and Rowena has got her purse under her arm and she is ready to go. She was very agitated and I said, "What's the matter with you, Rowena?" She said, "Do you see the mail on your dining room table? Do you see those pieces of mail?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Let me tell you how they got there." She said, "I was in the kitchen and I was fixing the baby's lunch. And I looked up and I saw a man coming through the front door and he had mail in his hand and he put it on the dining room table. And I thought, oh, that must be Mr. Farrow." So I went on about my lunch. He didn't acknowledge me or anything. And then he went right on into the hall. Now, off the dining room was a hall, a little tiny hall. If you go into the hallway straight ahead is the little bathroom. To the left is the nursery. To the right is our bedroom. So she just figured he was going in to see the baby or to the bathroom or something. Well, he didn't come back out, and she didn't hear anything. So she got to wondering, gee, maybe that wasn't Mr. Farrow. So, curious, she said, she went to the hall, and the bathroom door was open, and she could see he wasn't in there, and the master bedroom door was open, and he wasn't in there. And so she stepped into the nursery, and he wasn't in there. Now, there's no way out from those three rooms without walking in front of her. And so she said, "Miss Farrow, there's something wrong here." She said, "You got anybody in the family what's passed over?" And I said, "Well, actually, yes. My husband's dad just died." And she said, "Aha! And is he about 5'10" and maybe got a little fringe of brown hair and wears glasses and kind of stocky?" I said, "Yes!" She said, "I quit." That was the end of Rowena.
Well, I have questions about why he came over to deliver the mail. I mean, is that something he did in the past? Or?
No, he had never actually come to my house alone, ever.
Oh.
I wasn't really that close to him. I liked him a lot, but he was a very quiet man. They lived a long way from us. He had never come by the house alone. I'd never seen him alone. But I do have let me give you my answer to that, because people would say, why did Rowena see him and not his wife and not his son and not his daughters or even you? And my answer to that is only in coming to someone who didn't know him would the story be believed by the family. And why did he bring the mail? Because it was tangible. Because she could say, "You see that mail on that dining room table? Let me tell you how it got there." If he'd come to his wife, we would have all thought that was wishful thinking. We wouldn't have believed her.
We would have thought it was grief.
Same thing with his daughters or his son. With me, they'd just say I'm lying. But Rowena is the only one who would be able to identify him, describe him, and everybody would know it was true. And I think he did go in there and look at Dean, but he didn't have to materialize to look at Dean.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So that was his way of letting the family know that he was okay.
You know, another reason I'm wondering of why he appeared to her mm-hmm. is if she could see ghosts. It seems like some people have more of an ability to see ghosts. Like, I've lived in two haunted houses where other people have seen ghosts, but I haven't.
You've never seen one?
No, I've never seen one. So I don't apparently be able to see them, although other family members of mine can. One of the reasons why I think maybe he appeared to her because she could see him is she didn't say, do you have any other family members? That's what I would have said. Do you have any other family members? She said, do you have any family members who have passed? So I'm wondering.
Well, it's because he disappeared in the house.
Well, yeah. But I'm one, you know, that she may have seen other.
She sure didn't act like it was routine.
Okay.
I didn't get that impression at all.
Okay.
You have another ghost story of yours?
Well, I will continue with my son, Brian, who had the cat thrown at him. He moved into an old mansion that was built right around the 1900s.
Is that big house he's in now out in Holton?
Yeah. And what's interesting about that is several people have been in that house and have experienced loud noises and footsteps following them down the hall and big boxes dropping or nothing apparently fell. Oh, well, I told you I haven't seen a ghost, but I've heard a ghost in that house. I'll tell you about that, but I want to finish telling my story about what Brian saw.
Okay.
Brian was in bed talking to his girlfriend who was not in the same town via computer. So he had his computer set up and they were talking on Facebook or
whatever.
Skype or whatever. And so she could see what was going on in his bedroom pretty much. And she said she would see a lot of shadows. And while they were talking, and she could see his bed and his wall and so on. But while they were talking, he had a sheet on the bed that was underneath him, and the sheet literally was lifted up about a foot beside him and pulled up. So, you know, it came up against his leg, and not only did he see it, but she saw it on the computer. And he jumped out of bed and yelled, "Get the blank out!" And he could hear somebody running down the stairs, running down the front porch. And he is a dog breeder, and the entire dog yard just erupted into barks. I mean, it was like all of the dogs were aware that this was happening, not only Brian and his fiance who saw it, but when my daughter Trish had a baby who was nursing, she would go up in the second floor to nurse in a bedroom so she'd have privacy. And this little baby would be pointing, you know, pre-verbal, pointing at nothing. You know, this was nothing. There was nobody or nothing there. And
is this the same house we're talking about?
Yes.
So when Brian's sister, your daughter, would visit and she'd want to feed the baby, she went to the second floor
right.
for privacy.
Right.
And okay.
So we thought, well, maybe the baby could see the ghost who primarily lived up on the third floor. Mm-hmm. They had a third floor, and at that time, even though it was finished, it had, you know, a solid wood floor, it was totally open and there were no rooms. There was just, you know, one big room.
Mm-hmm.
Finished but no place to hide. And so Brian and Trish, my daughter, and the baby and I went upstairs to ask the baby if the baby could see anything.
Mm-hmm.
And Trish was first, and she was at the top of the stairs, and the stairway was kind of dark. However, it was daylight, so the third floor had sun going into it. So the third floor was brighter than this. Yes. And so you could see a strip of light under the door.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter saw somebody walking across in front of the door. And I didn't see that. I was behind her. But when she opened the door, Brian and I both heard a pretty loud noise that I have never heard before and I can't describe. It sounded like kind of a whoosh of wind a big gust of wind with rattly chains. I know that sounds kind of weird, but I can't even describe it. But we both heard it, and it was pretty loud. Yeah, I think it's interesting that certain people seem to have similar experiences over and over and over, and then other people don't see anything or hear anything. And why do you think that might be?
I don't know. I've always felt like if you see a ghost, then they're on a certain frequency, and you happen to, either yours is higher and theirs is lower, so you're at the same place, so you're visible. I have no idea. I mean, I really don't read ghost stories, and I don't really follow ghost stories. But when things happen in your own life, you're talking about a house. I wouldn't even go to talk about this, but I will. We lived in Seal Beach, California, and the houses are very close together. And, you know, it's a lovely, lovely neighborhood. It's not full of old, broken-down mansions, I guess is where I'm headed with this. My husband, Larry, at that time, was not a believer in ghosts. And since it wasn't, you know, particularly one of my favorite stories, we didn't have a great deal of occasion to talk about ghosts. I just knew that he went foo-foo over anything like that. He just thought that was full of bull. Well, we had two guest rooms up on the second floor and a master bedroom there. The attic was just simply a crawl space, no more than that. So when we would have guests stay overnight in this one particular guest room, never did anyone say that they didn't comment on hearing somebody walking in the hall during the night. And so we laughingly started referring to Casper, but it was a joke. And we just said, no, it's just the house. And that wasn't an old house. It was 22 years old, but that's not ancient. And we bought it from the original owners. And nobody we knew of died there, you know, no history to it. Anyway, one Sunday, I went over to my sister-in-law's to return a book I'd borrowed, and Larry was home alone. Now, the living room and dining room in this house, I don't know if you know this model house, but it's common that the living room and dining room is one long, long space with no division in it. And it's the entire width of the house. So when you come in the front door, there's a corridor, there's a hallway that leads past other rooms, but you end up in this huge living room with a dining room at a far end that opens into a kitchen. So anyway, the dining room table is over in that corner, and or that end of the living space. Larry's on the sofa at the other end of the living space, and he's reading. And all of a sudden, out of his peripheral vision, he saw movement over by the dining room table. Now, it's like 2 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon. And he looked up, and there stood a man who he said was probably 6'2 or 3. Larry himself was 6'4 and a half, so he felt he was somebody about his size. The man was very slender, and he was dressed in a blue-gray tunic. But it wasn't, when we say that, we think of a World War I soldier or Confederate soldier, maybe. He said, no, it was nothing like that. But from where Larry sat, he said he was so struck by the beauty of the fabric. He could actually determine what beautiful fabric it was. And it was like a tunic, but it was like a soldier's uniform. But it wasn't any uniform he ever saw. The man had black hair. And he said, what got him is the man was standing there at the dining room table looking at Larry, and he had the most compassionate look on his face Larry had ever seen. The man's face was so filled with kindness. This slender man in this beautiful tunic was just looking at Larry with complete compassion. But it scared the bejoojie juice out of Larry. He said that the man was just as three-dimensional as you and me, except right about just a few inches where the tunic stopped, the man stopped. He just was, there were no legs to him. And about that time, I drove up, and Larry heard the car pull into the driveway, and he jumps up, and he throws open that door, and I tell you, he was very pale, very pale. And so we decided, he said, that's no one to be afraid of. But Esther, what did it mean? And I said, I guess it means he lives here. But you know, the house was only built 22 years before. Mm-hmm. What is his history with the house? Mm-hmm. But we would hear him after he made himself visible to Larry. Mm-hmm. I never saw him. Mm-hmm. But we would hear him very definitely. Mm-hmm. And another time, I was gone. And when I came home, Larry was standing in front of the front door. He put his car in the driveway and the hose would hook up beside the front door. And he was washing the car. And when he turned around, he was facing the street. When he turned back around, he was facing the house. And that same man was right outside our front door and again was looking at Larry with this incredibly compassionate look on his face. Mm-hmm. And again, he did not exist from his dark trousers, from about just a few inches of black trousers. Mm-hmm. And then I came home right after that, and Larry said, "I'm a firm believer now. Mm-hmm. I know there are ghosts. I've seen it." Mm-hmm. But we don't have anything to hook that up with.
Well, did you do any research?
No.
Okay. Esther, one of the things I've always wondered is what you were talking about earlier. Why don't ghosts seem to need legs or feet? I have talked to a lot of people who have seen ghosts, and it's pretty common that ghosts either don't have feet, they don't have all of their body, some of them have just their torso up, and some of them are floating a foot off the ground.
I don't really have an answer for that because our experiences are so different. You know, I've told the story many times about my grandpa. When I was a little girl, he sat in a rocking chair at the foot of the bed, and Mom and Grandma would be talking over on the sofa next to the wall, and I'm on the bed playing with a button box, and my grandpa is always in that rocking chair. And I had the same image all the time, the black pants, a black sweater, a little black bow tie, white shirt. He's always just got this darling twinkle in his eye, and I just loved him. And every time he would glance at me, I would get all bashful. And, you know, I'm a little girl, and I just would get so bashful when he would look at me with that twinkly look in his eye. Well, all of the time, you know, that I saw him at the kitchen table, or no matter where I saw him, he would always just give me that twinkly-eyed little look. And he was always doing something logical, like sitting in a rocking chair while Mom and Grandma are talking, sitting at the dining room table while Grandma's at the sink fixing their lunch. Logical things, and he's certainly three-dimensional. I didn't know until I was 52 friggin' years old that he had died before I was born. Now explain that. I could not believe that. My grandpa was as real to me as any grandpa. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, here's the story of Mr. Farrow that I just told. Mm-hmm. While I didn't see him, Rowena certainly did, and he certainly had feet and hands and all the things that went with it. You remember this because this has happened since I've known you. You know how the library has this thing once a year called Kansas 50 Greatest Writers. Well, this one year that I was participating, the show ended, you know, the thing goes on all day. It's a big expo, and you've got your table, and all your books are there, and you greet people, and you sign your books. You hopefully sell one or two. Well, at the end of the day, I was packing up all the unsold books and my little roll-along, and I went into another room to help another writer pack up their stuff, because there's always a display and it's kind of a hassle. Anyway, as I was walking into the other room, this man approached me, and I would say that he was about 5'8", and my first thought was that I'll bet he's a minister or a missionary. Mm-hmm. He had that sweet, clear-eyed countenance about him that looked like a man of faith for some reason. He was rather bald, and he wore glasses, and he had on a three-piece suit, and it was a light brown suit, and he just looked like a minister to me. Anyway, he approached me, and he had a book in his hand, and he said, "Excuse me, are you Esther Luttrell?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "My wife would like you to have a copy of her book." Well, at the end of those kind of expos, writers often exchange books. "Give me a copy of your book, I'll give you a copy of mine." Mm-hmm. And frankly, I had more books than I could ever read. And if I have time to read, then I should be writing.
Right.
You know? So I really didn't want another book, thank you very much. But it was a very slender volume, and it had a very pretty cover. It was very slender. And he held it out, and I took it, and I said, well, thank you. That's really sweet of you, with no intention of reading it. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to hurt his feelings because he was so sweet. Then he said, my wife died and went to heaven. And now that kind of caught my attention. And I said, oh. And he said, as a matter of fact, our minister actually preached a sermon on it. And then we found out that ministers around the country had read it and often gave sermons on it. And I said, really? Now, I did intend to read it. Mm-hmm. I thought, it's very slender anyway. And the book was called You Live Forever. And it had her name on it, Gladys Hargis, whom I had never heard of. And he said, well, my wife's not a writer. And when you read it, you'll see. It's just her. She's a farm girl. And she just tells of an incredible experience in her own words. And I said, well, thank you very much. He said, she's out in the rotunda. Now, most of us great 50 writers, we were in one big room, and those that didn't fit in there, they got to be in the rotunda, which everybody saw first before they came in. And there were like maybe four tables of writers out there. So he said, she's in the rotunda. If you get time to stop by, please do. Say hello to her. And I said, thank you, I will. Well, then he left. And I went back and put the book on my table. And then I helped another writer pack up. And by the time I got to the rotunda, everybody was gone. And so I went on home. Now, I didn't think any more about that for months. One day I'm sitting in my living room and I'm thinking, gosh, I wish I had something good to read. And I kind of glance around because you know how many books and bookshelves I have, but they're not in the living room. Some are, but nothing right handy from sitting at the sofa. There on my telephone table, which is just big enough to hold the telephone, nothing else. It's just exactly the size of the telephone. Perched up there on the telephone was this book, You Live Forever. Now, you know I didn't perch a book up there. So I thought, well, what's that doing here? And then that's that one that nice man gave me. And I opened it, and it said, to Esther, God bless, Gladys Hargis. Oh, bless her heart. She inscribed it for me. So I started reading it. Well, the man was right. She was not a writer. And in fact, the publisher had done her a great disservice. There were so many typographical errors, so many errors in it. And I started marking them with a little red pen, and there was one on every page. But the story was captivating. And I could tell it was a farm lady trying to tell her story, you know, to tell about something that's so incredible. And I went and I looked her up in the phone book, and I called her, and she answered, and I saw her big, deep, booming voice. And I said, Miss Hargis, my name is Esther Luttrell. She didn't react at all. I said, I just finished reading your book, and it's absolutely delightful. It's wonderful. And she said, well, thank you, honey. I said, but would I offend you if I tell you that it has errors in it that shouldn't have gotten past a publisher? And may I make you an offer? This is a story that should be read by everybody. I'd be happy to edit it for you and publish it for you. No charge. No charge at all. But I just want to see this book get out there the right way. And she said, well, thank you, honey. And so anyway, she invited me over, and I went the next day. And as I was driving down the street, and I got almost to the turnoff, I just flashed on her husband. And I thought, oh, I hope he's home. I would like to see that sweet man again. So I turn in, and I get into her driveway, and she opens the door. I swear to heaven, the lady probably was 6 foot tall. And a big farm lady. And all I could think of was, my goodness, she had him surrounded. Isn't that a silly thing to think? But she was just so darling. Oh, come on in, honey. And so I went in. And we were talking about her book. And I sat on a footstool, and she sat in this great big recliner. I'm sitting there telling her what wonderful the book is. Now, behind her is a shelf on the wall. And on the little shelf, just a little one, mm-hmm. was a framed picture of the man who gave me mm-hmm. a copy mm-hmm. of the book. Mm-hmm. And so she's telling me how she said there are a lot of things I couldn't write because I didn't know how to describe it. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. it's an incredible experience and I don't have a vocabulary for it. And she said, when I got to heaven, I said to my angel that had taken me there, could I go back and stay with my husband until he passes because he's very sick mm-hmm. and he needs me? And so the angel didn't speak in a voice, but communicated with me. And I knew my angel was saying, let me ask. So I waited out in a meadow. There were two other angels talking by a great big fence, like a wrought iron fence, but very tall. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, she saw the most incredible white building. Just, it went on and on and on mm-hmm. forever and glistened, and it was beautiful. But the gates were shut, and these two angels were talking. He went over to those two angels, and they seemed to be conversing somehow. Mm-hmm. He comes back, and he said, what Gladys said, was very contemporary language. He said, yes, you may go back, but you are on borrowed time. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, she had been looking while he was talking to the angels. This incredible garden was mm-hmm. to her left, and it was full of the most beautiful flowers with colors that she couldn't describe because mm-hmm. we don't have them on this planet. Mm-hmm. And so she said to the angel, before I go, may I walk through the garden? And he said, yes. And so she said she walked through the garden, and there was a little path that went off to her right, and on the path was a bench that looked as if it was made of marble. But there was a woman seated on the bench, and the bench seemed to conform to her body. And she thought, well, how can that be? It looks like marble. Anyway, the woman was very beautiful, very serene, and she beckoned for Gladys to come over there. And Gladys said, suddenly she realized who it was. It was Jesus' mother, Mary. And she walked over to her, and she said she was just tongue-tied. And she looked at the woman, and she said, me? Why do you want to talk to me? I'm not Catholic. And Mary said, I'm not either. Hmm. Isn't that lovely? So then she said, Mary talked to her for a bit, and she didn't want to divulge what it was in her book because it was so private. Hmm. And so then she came out and left the garden and was back in a hospital room where she had been. And so she had been pronounced dead, and it was a miracle that her heart started beating and she lived. Well, she said then she rallied and she was able to take care of her husband until he died. So I am thinking to myself, you know, me who I didn't do well when I married. I don't know if I made bad choices or they did, but that sure didn't work out very well. Anyway, I'm thinking this great big lovely farm lady got two wonderful husbands, obviously. I couldn't even get one and she got two. And I thought, isn't that remarkable? So while she's telling me about this, and I'm looking at the picture of the husband that gave me the book, mm-hmm. I said to her, so you've had two husbands. And she said, well, honey, I only had one husband. And I said, oh, but you said he died. She said, yeah, he died 4 years ago. I said, no, is that your husband, the picture of him on that shelf? She said, that's him. I said, no, ma'am. That's who gave me a copy of this book. And I told her what happened and how I got mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. She said, honey, I never heard of you in my life till you called me, but I'll tell you what. He appeared one other time to somebody like that. And he's taken care of me. You're going to fix my book. He's taken care of me. Aww. And so I did. You know, I edited her book and it came out and it's available on Amazon. Mm-hmm. And Gladys has gone on now. But I often think about that. That man was three-dimensional. He had his feet and his hands and everything else he needed that I could see. We had on a suit. I don't know if everything was there. But, you know, why did he choose me out of 50 authors? And I thought about that. I thought, maybe because I do edit other people's books. I do mm-hmm. publish other people's books. And generally, I don't charge them. And maybe he just knew that I would mm-hmm. help her, and that mm-hmm. story needed to be told. Mm. That's all I could figure.
That's a great story.
Wow. I know,
it's interesting that he carried a book a long ways, too, a physical book.
I know. Yes. Yeah, I've had other people say that. You know, I had a phone call not too long ago, Diane, and it was from a fellow, Dave, who took my workshop, my screenwriting workshop, 20 years ago, and he emails me. And he said, "Esther, I just finished reading your book, Dear Dean, Love, Mom," where I talk about, you know, having seen Dean after he died. Mm-hmm. And he said, "If I didn't know you and didn't know you don't lie, I would think you made up every word. But I know you don't, and I know it really happened. But I thought I'd tell you, it's a good thing I know you, or I sure would believe this story." Well, I think that's true of a lot of people who don't say, who don't tell about an encounter they may have. They don't want to hear, "I don't believe you." Mm-hmm. They don't want people to think they made something up just to get attention, mm-hmm. you know?
I know that an awful lot of people have seen ghosts, but they don't talk about it.
And you're writing a book about it.
Well, that's one of the things I'm writing about. I'm writing a book that started off, it was going to be Extraordinary Coincidences. I wanted to kind of examine what the heck synchronicity is and what are coincidences and why. But people kept telling me all these other stories that didn't have anything to do with coincidences. So now I'm not sure where this book is going. It may be more than one book, but it may be just something about extraordinary experiences. I really want to call it something like "What in the Heck is Going On?" Or, I mean, weird stuff's going on that our culture doesn't talk about much. But I firmly believe, I used to be a social worker before I always have been an astrologer and often worked as an astrologer and a social worker at the same time. But as a social worker and as an astrologer, people tell me stuff they don't tell other people.
Yeah, sure.
And so I have heard a huge number of ghost stories, and especially since I'm writing the book, because I will ask people, you know, "Have you had any unusual experiences?" And I am pretty, almost everybody has, and they often tell me that they have not talked about it with anybody else because they didn't want to be ridiculed.
Yes.
Or they didn't want to be, you know, labeled as crazy. And just one example, once I was working at one social work position and I was moving to another, and I went over to the new place to sign some paperwork before I started. And the social worker there who was showing me around the building showed me my office and showed me where everything was. And she said, "Oh, by the way, this place is haunted." So I went back to my old place and I told people who, there were six of us sitting around a table. And I said, "Hey, by the way, my new place is supposedly haunted." And I found out at that time that all six of those people who were sitting at that table, including me, were firmly convinced that they either were or had lived in a haunted house. But I had worked with these people for a couple of years, and we had never discussed it. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really interesting that six out of six of us had experienced
that. Well, they were admitting it to you.
Right, right. Yeah.
If everybody would admit it, I think you'd be surprised.
Right.
You got any more stories?
No, well, I've got lots of stories, but I think we probably better go. But it was wonderful to sit and chat with you.
Yeah, it was fun. It always is. We'll have to do it again, and we probably will.
Okay, good. Okay. Good.
This could be True Ghost Stories 1. There could be a True Ghost Stories 2.
Oh, there could be, man. I have gathered so many ghost stories from people I know. It's just amazing. It's amazing to me how many people who I've known for decades and have never known that until I flat out ask them. Mm-hmm. And they knew I was receptive. And then they told me.
Well, you see, receptive, now that opens up one more story. Can I tell one more quick story?
One more story, I'm sorry.
Dean's last Christmas, or Christmas before, two Christmases before he died. We were visiting my mother-in-law in Miami, and my husband and myself, and Dean flew in and joined us on Christmas Day. He had never been to my mother-in-law's home before in Miami because we lived in California. And it's the first time he'd ever been to Miami with us. Then the next morning after we all arrived, Larry always got up and had breakfast with his mother, and they read the Bible. That had been a ritual when they were together since he was a little boy. So he was already up and out of the room by the time I woke up, and there was a knock at my door, and I said, come in, and it was Dean. And he was in the guest room next door to us. And he said, Mom, are you awake? Can I tell you something? I said, sure. And I scooted over and patted, you know, him to sit down beside me and tell me his problems. And he said, I don't know how to say this. I said, spit it out. He said, well, last night when I turned out the lights and I was just getting into the bed, a little boy was at the foot of the bed. I said, a little boy was at the foot of the bed. He said, he was, Mom. And he was a little thin boy, and he had on just a really, really thin little t-shirt. And I don't remember what else, but he looked so forlorn. And I was just shocked to see him there. And I said, hello. And the little boy said, can you play ball with me? And I said, no, it's dark and it's late and I have to go to bed. And the little boy looked so sad. And then Dean said, what's your name? And he said, John. And he said, how old are you, John? And he said, Mom, I think he said he was 9, but he looked more like 7. And he just had the saddest look on his face. And I said, well, John, I have to go to bed now. And John said, you can't play ball with me? And I said, no, I can't. And the little boy disappeared. He said, Mom, what do you make of that? I said, I have no idea. I mean, I've never heard of any children that ever lived in this house. Larry is an only child. And he lived here from 1948, I think, on until he left. He stayed in Miami for college. And right after that, he moved to California. So we didn't know what to make of it. And so he went back in his room. And I got up and got dressed and went downstairs. Larry was still at the breakfast table with his mom, who heard us stirring, and she started making some pancakes. I poured a cup of coffee, and Dean was sitting at the breakfast table, Dean and Larry. And I said to my mother-in-law, do you think anybody, a little boy, ever lived here that was named John? And Diane, I got to tell you, if looks could kill, I'd be dead right now. She turned around and she gave me the evil eye, and Larry looked at me kind of panicked, and he's shaking his head subtly, you know, like, mm-hmm. no. Mm-hmm. And so I don't say anything else, and now my mother-in-law's kind of slamming things around. And I sit down, and I eat my pancakes and drink my coffee, and she leaves, and then Larry and Dean got up, and he left. And Larry said to me, Esther, I always thought I was an only child. I just learned myself that mother had a little boy before me, and his name was John, and he died when he was very young. I just said to Dean later, Dean said, what do you make of it? And I told him what Larry told me. And it was Dean, actually, who said, oh, my goodness, Mama, nobody's ever talked about him. And I said, yes, not. Larry just found out. He said, he's just waiting to be acknowledged, Mom. And so that's what we thought. But you say, what triggered that you said to me? You said something about being receptive.
Yeah.
And I thought later, because Dean and I both accepted that John was reality, that made it easier for him to communicate with me when he died 2 years later. And that sort of set the stage.
Yes.
Okay, now we really are going.
Okay.
Thank you again, hon. And everybody, thank you for listening. See you next time around. Don't forget our other podcast excursion stories that are here for you to enjoy. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
This is Jeff Evans, thanking you for listening to an episode from Podcast Excursions' On Purpose series, programs that listeners can depend on for conversations and observations that strive to provide quality programs created to entertain, educate, and enlighten. Esther Luttrell was host and producer. Recording rights to the theme Whispering Rain, composed and performed by Tony Ballou, was made possible through the courtesy of Jack Allen.
I just want to take a moment to thank you for soaring with us on the wings of imagination as you listen to stories we're having so much fun creating for you. If you enjoy what you hear, take a moment to subscribe to Mojave Beach Productions on your favorite podcast app. And thanks a million.